Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Bucetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Okay, so I'm super pumped because I get to see my friend Phil's face again, and I just finished his second book last night and sent a group text, Phil, that was just like, read Phil's book. That's it. Like, that's the text. That's the message. Read the book. It's called The Prophetic Lens, The Camera and Black Moral Agency from MLK to Darnella Frazier. Phil, are you pumped about this about to make its way into the world?
Am I? Oh my goodness. I'm so excited. I feel really good about it. You know, it's 3 years in the making, and I didn't realize that. I was just thinking about when I started writing it, but the original idea and original paper goes back to 2019.
Wow.
And I repurposed it a couple of times for some journal articles. And after the Derek Chauvin trial, I was like, okay, I got to write this. I got to flesh this out some more. And I feel really good about it. I'm sure there's going to be some critique. Everything has critique. But overall, I'm excited. I'm pumped up, ready to engage people with this book.
Yeah, it was incredible. Like I said, I finished it last night. I felt like, so yesterday was Labor Day, and I felt like I just kept saying to my husband, okay, I've just got, if I can do one more chapter, I'm going to do one more chapter. And I one more chaptered my way until about 8:30 last night. And I was like, man, this was so good. But here's what I'll tell you. So this is not a critique. I want to tell you this as a friend, but as a reader. I read the subtitle, okay, from MLK to Darnella Frazier, and I was ready to jump right in to cameras with MLK and civil rights movement and all of that stuff. And you did not let me do that. And at first I was super frustrated. I was like, Phil, I want to be like with the camera right now. But it was so beautiful. The first half of the book really is foundational for this conversation. And I know that you did that intentionally, but as a reader, even though I was familiar with much of what was said in the first half of the book, the way that you lay out the history, the way that you talk about the narrative and Black narrative in the U.S. specifically, we needed that cake part. You know, this frosting of what I really wanted to tell me about the camera, tell me about this, tell me about that. That's an amazing second half, but we needed this foundation again for you to take us through the history of the narrative history in America before we got to the media, George Floyd, you know, all of those kinds of things. So I just want to note that as an observation and then ask you, what was your thinking behind that and the way that you kind of laid this out?
Great question. And I was as frustrated writing it as you were reading it.
The frustration didn't last long.
I was ready by chapter two or three to get into it.
Yeah.
Initially. And then wrestling with, I knew I needed to have a foundation for what do you mean by prophetic?
Yeah.
Like, that's the first thing. Yeah, we can talk about the camera and all that stuff, but what do you mean by prophetic? What do you mean by this moral agency for Black people? Why is that so important? Why is the camera so important? So talking with my editor, and he pushed me to, he's like, Phil, we gotta lay some more foundation here. And so I just started to try to unpack, you know, take a little journey. Let me talk about the Black experience. Let me talk about the part that's not seen, the unseen violence, or the part of the Black experience that that people outside of the Black community just may not be aware of. Like, this is the daily. See, we see the shooting, the death, the violence, but there's something before that. There's a lot before that. There are things that are daily in our lives that just, I can talk about it all day, but people won't necessarily believe me. Then I had to talk about, well, where's the violence coming from historically? Then we get into the prophetic, the use of the word prophetic, and then we start to tell the narrative, how the narrative has been told. So all that was necessary to set up. And hopefully people see that it places, now the camera has more value by the time you get to it, right? Mm-hmm. So that was the thinking behind that.
Yeah. So I want you to connect these two things for me, because as you were just talking about the unseen violence, right? What happens before the shooting or the over-policing, the violence, all of that, what happens before? You and I have spent some time together, and so this may have hit me in a different way because we personally know each other. And meaning, like, I've stood beside you, I know what you look like, right? Mm-hmm. But you talk about going for a jog in Pasadena and having to make a decision on a chilly day whether or not you're going to put your skull cap on. This is not far-fetched, I think, in the way that you threaded this together when you talk about the what happens before, the unseen stuff, the daily stuff, and how we got there. Tie your decision to put on a skull cap or not as a tall, big Black man to Birth of a Nation.
Yeah. So part of it is that narrative that was created by films like Birth of a Nation. And Birth of a Nation is kind of the film that everyone goes back to that created this narrative that to fear Black men. If you watch the film, and it's hard to watch, but if you watch the film, you see every aspect of it, the subtleties to the most blatant. It created this narrative. Well, that narrative has lasted, right? So that's part of it. Then the other part is my own personal experience. So I still think about literally 20 plus years ago, walking to the bus stop in a neighborhood that I lived in with my mom at the time for almost 2 years. I was a personal trainer. So I wear sports gear, athletic gear. It was 30 some degrees outside. So I have a knit hat on. I have a hoodie on. I have my backpack because I'm a personal trainer. So I'm going to the gym. I'm going to be there all day and all night training clients off and on. I'm walking to the bus stop, minding my business. I'm not looking around at anything. I'm not looking suspicious. It's too cold. I want to get to the bus stop, get on the bus, and get to work. I live in the neighborhood, so I'm comfortable. Well, apparently there was somebody, a white man, who it was a holiday. So he was off that day and he saw me. He called the police. That's a violence. That's the violence I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. The fact that he sees me and assumes criminality.
Right.
He doesn't see my humanity. See, violence starts there. It starts when we don't see the humanity in another person. It's not what we see on camera oftentimes, that's the terminal end. But there's a progression of violence that starts when you don't see my humanity. So it happened to be a holiday, and I realized, oh, I missed the bus. So I turned to walk back to my house, and I saw the cop sitting further down the street. I didn't think anything of it. And he shoots down the street towards me. I still didn't think anything of it. I thought he got a call, someone's doing something up the street. And I don't live in a bad neighborhood. At that time, it was a middle class to upper middle class, really nice neighborhood. And then he turns on my street. I was like, wow, it's in my neighborhood. I'm not thinking he's coming for me. And then he turns toward the curb as where I was walking. I thought he was driving up on the curb. So now my heart's racing because he was flying down the street towards me. And he gets out of the car. He rushes towards me and asks me quick questions. Where you live? Like he's trying to catch me. And I gave him my address and I said, what's going on? And he told me someone called. They saw someone that fit a description with a knit hat, a hoodie, and they didn't recognize walking the neighborhood. And I said to myself, all of that for that? Because someone just, and I said, so you're telling me if I called y'all because I saw a white guy walking through our neighborhood that I don't recognize, will you come and do the same thing? He hands me my ID back and says, you have a nice day, sir.
Wow.
And it, my day, I mean, I was pissed for days, but to this day, before I go running, now I will wear a knit hat because I'm not going to go out there and get sick, sweating in the cold in the wintertime when it's cool at night or in the morning here, but I don't put a hoodie on. To this day, I don't like wearing hoodies. If I wear a hoodie, it's probably because I'm just like, you know what? I'm going to wear this hoodie today. But typically, I don't really like wearing a hoodie because that sticks in the back of my mind. That's just one of three times in my neighborhoods in different states that I was pulled over by law enforcement. And then you got the idea of black guy with a knit hat in the stereotypes that going back to Birth of a Nation, the stereotypes that come with how we may carry ourselves. And I think about those things. Sometimes I don't care, and sometimes I don't have the energy to deal with what may come of it. So I challenge myself sometimes. I wrestle sometimes. Mm-hmm. Do you want to wear this today? But again, I'm not going to get sick running and sweating and not have anything on my head. So I will wear a knit hat. That's just what it is. People just have to deal with their own biases, but the fact that I have to think about it because of my experience and because of those narratives that are out there.
Thanks for sharing that, Phil. I hate leading with it, but you led with it in the book. And I think it's important. I think it's important that we lead with that because, as you mentioned, when we started this off, there are just some things that people don't think about unless they have to think about it because it's their everyday experience. A lot of people don't think about it, or they don't want to think about it, or they have never thought about it, or they think that it's a myth or it's overplayed, you know, some of this. But part of the reason I asked you to connect those things is because our history matters. And yeah, one of the things that you do, I think, brilliantly in this book is you don't let our history remain our history. You pull it through. Yeah. So we go from Birth of a Nation to January 6th, and we can see all of this is connected.
Yeah.
It's all connected. I do want to say, I have not watched Birth of a Nation. I know of Birth of a Nation. What I did not know, there were a couple of things that I kind of starred in the book that I was like, what? This was one of them. That Birth of a Nation was based on a novel written by a Baptist pastor.
Yeah. Yep.
Isn't that great?
Yep.
I'm like, are you kidding me here? And I thought, why this was, it was just in a paragraph, you know, I'm like, this is like, this needs to be like in subtitle print. I don't know what to, I mean, like what? And that narrative continues. And that is not our history only anymore. Yeah. Right. And we could anyway list 100 resources for complicity and.
Well, let me speak to that real quick. Cause I just had an exchange with a pastor, an evangelical pastor. And when I posted something, I said my post this last week was, there are far too many nonprofit PROPHET churches than there are nonprofit PROFIT churches. And he said, I knew I would get something from him because he always does. I told him, I knew I would hear from you because you're always, your surveillance, you're always watching over my site. And I purposely said surveillance. That's part of my research dealing with the plantation model, that there's a constant surveillance. And we went back and forth for a little bit. And I was very direct with him the last few times. I told him, actually, I said, don't even message me anymore because this is getting annoying. But I said, your evangelical sensibilities show. And he responded, you know, I'm proud of my evangelical sensibilities. And I haven't responded to that part, and I might not, but I wanted him to understand the roots of those evangelical sensibilities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the ties to white supremacy. Yes. He will probably deny it without doing the research. That's the sad part, because he wants to hold to whatever positive imagery, perception that he has of his roots, because to do the work is to come to a place of lament and grieving, which you actually find the ties to white supremacy. But I just thought it was interesting that we talk about connecting the past to today, mm-hmm. and just mm-hmm. having this exchange a couple of days ago, and him not even realizing, like, that's not a good thing, in my opinion, your ties to, you know, evangelicalism.
Yeah, but it isn't. But it is important, because we do have a choice to delve into that history, to do the research, to read sources like yours that are well researched, and to look on our own. It was funny. It was something really trivial in your in one of these chapters. I'll tell you what it was. This is funny because we like MJ in our house here, and I was like, "They're not playing Michael Jackson on MTV. Like, what?" You know, because I grew up watching Michael Jackson on, like, Nickelodeon. They used to have a show called Nick Rocks, right? And we would VH1 and all. My parents may not have let me watch MTV, but anyway. But I grew up watching Michael Jackson. It was dumbfounding to me that there was a time when they wouldn't play his music videos, right? And so I read it out loud, and I said, I know. I know. Phil's got a footnote here, and so I went, you know, and looked it up and saw it, which is just a silly, trivial example, but it's like, but this stuff is out there, right? This stuff is out there. Yeah. It's not a secret, but it is my husband's favorite quote from Mark Charles. When Mark Charles is talking about American history in general, and someone says, I didn't know that. And Mark's answer is sometimes, well, you weren't supposed to find out.
Yep. Exactly. And that movement has heightened today.
Yeah. Yes.
It's heightened today.
Yes.
It's never stopped.
Please
it's
stop.
Just
yes.
Heightened, amplified today. You're not supposed to find out. And I tell this story all the time. I don't know if I shared this the last time I was on here, but there was a young lady I taught a class in Missouri, and she was angry after one of my sessions during the break. And I thought she was mad at me, so I wanted to engage that. Let's process this together. Because if you're mad at me, you're mad at the facts. And she said, I'm angry. I said, why? And she said, because my parents and my grandparents did not teach me this stuff. They didn't tell me this stuff. You weren't supposed to know.
That's right.
To borrow from Mark Charles. She wasn't supposed to know. And this is a young lady that was going to Chicago to do inner city ministry. Young white girl and her fiance, they're probably married now. They were on their way months after graduation. They were getting ready to graduate, and that's where they were going to go serve. How what's the likelihood that she could compound trauma, make things worse for certain kids without knowing their context, their history, and how we even got here? She wasn't supposed to know.
That's right. I wish that I had like a real, you know, great outline and everything for this interview, but I just don't. Okay. So I'm going to jump over.
Yeah.
Because one of the other things that I was like star. So the Birth of a Nation based on a novel written by a Baptist pastor. That was one. The second one was, and I'm actually really embarrassed by this one, but you bring out, so this is on the, you weren't supposed to find out. And I'm saying this, so this goes to the democratization of the camera and all this stuff. This goes to Darnella Frazier. This goes to all this. I apparently, in all of the coverage over George Floyd's murder, had never seen the original statement that the police gave of what happened.
Yep.
Phil, I was dumbfounded. Yep. I was mad. And that you weren't supposed to find out. Nobody was supposed to find out after that original official statement came out.
Here's the power of the camera. It's not just that it records an event happening, but even more so, it disrupts or creates narrative. Every one of us lives within a narrative. We have a narrative. We believe narratives. We're formed and conditioned by narratives. If you are a Christian and you're reading the Bible, you're reading a biblical narrative. It is a soap opera with a good ending, right? And so when that statement comes out, it's basically saying there's no there there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're not aware, apparently, that there's other footage. They went by their, so imagine if Darnella Frazier wasn't there and they went by the body cam footage, the editing, the gymnastics that would be done to present to the world their version of what happened. Even the surveillance cameras on the buildings across the street and what have you does not capture it all. And so people got to realize the presence of mind to pull the camera out, because it's not like you're watching something entertaining, you're watching something traumatic. She pulled the camera out, and then the resilience to stay. To stay. Rosa Parks had the presence of mind to, I'm not getting up. But the resilience to stay in spite of the threat of what would happen. And so that statement comes out, hoping to create a narrative. The camera, the video, and then is published, which further the democratization of power. Now she has every one of us has a platform to not just, we don't just record the camera. We now have a platform to publish it, its content. Now we can challenge that narrative. We can disrupt it. Now you have to do a double take. You have to say that was a pump fake. Because this defense right here, my basketball hat on right now. Right? Like that's what she did. That's what the camera does. And it's sad that the statement was even made that quickly, and that it's egregious.
I think what killed me, the part of it that was so obscene, was the quote was something like, he began to exhibit medical distress, and so he was taken to the hospital where he was pronounced dead. Why did he begin to exhibit medical distress?
Exactly.
No mention of the knee.
Exactly.
Like, I just had a former Fuller guy on the show. Scott Sundquist was on a week or two ago. And he talks about, of course, he's a historian, and he talks about history. Yes, you have to memorize facts, but we need to realize that it's narrative, right? And yeah. So, yes, he was exhibiting medical distress. That was a fact, right? He was taken to the hospital. That was a fact. He was pronounced dead. That was a fact. You've missed something in the narrative, though, if that is all you're reporting. If those are all the facts that you're reporting, you have missed something in the narrative. And that is going to continue to affect the people who say it and the people who hear it and the people who believe it or don't believe it from this point forward.
Yep. And so you made me think about the first chapter, Unseen Violence. And this is part of why it's unseen, is because we haven't controlled the narrative for the most part historically. And so facts come out. Like, I love it when people will say to me, but Lincoln freed the slaves. That's a fact. He made a decision as commander in chief. But let's go to the details. Let's get context. Let's look at the whole narrative. Let's look at some things that he said himself and see if you still celebrate, still celebrate the decision, but see if you still celebrate him the same. Because those facts are a part of, like you said, a part of a narrative. But, you know, that's part of, you know, for me, that's part of what it meant to be Black. I wish there was a camera to capture my grandfather's murder and my great-grandfather's murder, 20 years apart. Right? There are plenty of things in those events that we weren't supposed to know what happened.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because one of the things that you mentioned that I think is really noteworthy as a part of your story is that you had a home life that where your family was able to supplement your learning of Black history at home. You didn't just get what you would get at school, right? But I want to say, I don't know. I kind of want you to elaborate on that a bit, because I'm thinking of Black friends of mine who have told me they didn't have similar experiences. And so they're learning a lot of things as adults that they didn't grow up knowing. I have a father who studied political science and is kind of a little left of center. And so I did grow up learning a lot of the kind of the untold history stories, and specifically government issues and things like that. But it was better, I'm learning, than what a lot of my peers had, but still, you know, incomplete, right? Because he was just one person trying to do that. But I would like for you to just kind of elaborate on what was that like for you? What is it like to kind of realize that if someone isn't getting supplementary history at home or from another source, that what we're providing is incomplete? I don't know. Just talk about that for a minute.
Yeah. See, part of it is the era I grew up in. I was born in the earlier part of the 70s into the 80s. My grandparents are a big influence on me. But also the Black church. So in the AME church, we had Black history plays, Black history programs, I should say. And so that built into our theology, our faith, was our history. So, I remember doing a speech or something on Frederick Douglass or Richard Allen, right? So that was one source, Black church. I had an uncle, he passed away 7 years ago. He played college and pro football. And he was one of my first looking back, one of my first mentors. And he got me a book, a couple of books. They were college level books. And I think I was in middle school. I'm like, dude, I'm not reading this. And I remember skimming through some of it, though. I could understand. I mean, I was pretty, I could understand some things, but I didn't have the interest as much. I would get it from hip hop. I remember, particularly remember there's a song, Run DMC. It was basically a Black history song and just running through names and events and inventions and stuff like that. And I remember some of the things that they, you know, talked about. So it was important for my family to make sure we understood who we were. I had educators in my family. Now, the people who were born a little after me, maybe 5, 10, 15 years after, that was an era, even though we dealt with the crack epidemic, that was an era where you had a lot of upward mobility, especially going into the 90s. So I think my generation kind of dropped the ball when it comes to this. Generation before us was trying to equip us. Generation after us, millennials, on fire, want to cause, you know, social change. I think, though, my generation, we kind of dropped the ball because prosperity was in front of us. You started to see hip hop. You started to see actors. You started to see athletes get paid crazy money, more and more going to college. So I think we dropped the ball there. So it doesn't surprise me. And I've run into a lot of people in the Black community, unfortunately, that do not know the history. And so, but a cousin of mine, Dr. Rodney Smith at UMKC, he's at William Jewell College now. But he said, it doesn't matter what time in the morning you get up, you wake up, 6 o'clock in the morning or 10 o'clock in the morning, as long as you wake up. So those who are just now getting the information, they're up, they're awake, and that's okay. Just continue to learn, right? So that's how I look at it. You know, I had the resources, I had the people pushing me, teaching me, but everyone didn't have that. So, but now we don't really have the excuses because we have so much information in front of us. The question is whether or not you want to know.
Right. You know, something that you allude to in the book, I think you may say it explicitly one or two times, but this kind of thing that we're talking about, it's important that we all know it, right? It's not just important for the Black community to know this. And one of the examples that I give that makes me mad, like that woman was mad at that session in Missouri, is the Tulsa race massacre. Because I grew up in Oklahoma. So read here 12 years of Oklahoma state history, right? Or whatever it was. And I was in my 30s before I had even heard of it, even knew anything about it. And I'm like, how in the world is that even possible? How do I know the Oklahoma state bird, but I don't know that something this egregious happened in our state in the century that I was going to school in Oklahoma? How do I not know that? I went to my graduate degree at the University of Oklahoma. The professor who founded our department was the first Black property owner in that city as a professor in the 50s, maybe.
In Norman?
Yes. Wow. Oklahoma. Yeah. Yeah. The first Black property owner. This is not some, now, if you know where to hunt for it, you can find it, yeah. Right? But this was something I learned from you know, my advisor when I was in grad school, right? But this stuff is crazy. And this is stuff that we all need to know and be aware of, because it's Black history. It's our history. We need to know this collectively.
Absolutely. And, you know, if we were to broaden it out, we can look at same thing for Native history.
Yes.
The immigrant experience in history. We can go on and on.
Yeah.
But I think we have to be honest about why. Why don't we know? Number one, it's going to challenge this notion of American exceptionalism. And most, we don't want to do that. But what does it mean to be American? And if we're honest, the measuring stick to be American is white. So then we're going to have to relook. We have to take another look at what it means to be white. And the influence, the implications of white supremacy, white sovereignty. We have to look at all of that honestly. And those who have traditionally and historically been in power, their conscience can't handle that. You ever notice that there's no problem talking about the Holocaust? We should. We should never forget the Holocaust. And I tell people, it's one thing to know and read in the books. It's another thing to walk in the actual gas chambers in Auschwitz. I got goosebumps now remembering walking through the gas chambers in Auschwitz, seeing the actual hair that was taken off of the Jews. It's still there. Not all of it, like 2 tons are still behind a glass. They're gray. Baby shoes, suitcases, glasses, it makes it real. But America doesn't have a problem talking about the Holocaust. That's not on America's conscience. We were on the right side of history then. 9/11, we don't have a problem saying never forget. That includes white bodies as victims in that building. And there's an external enemy, and it's coming at all of us regardless of race. That's the narrative, right? There's an external enemy trying to infiltrate this country. And it doesn't matter what race, gender, age, whatever, they're coming for all of us. So now it includes white bodies. It would force people to have to not center whiteness, not center or include white bodies. To have to, our conscience has to now wrestle with this history. We have to now be willing to look at America differently. And those in power don't want that. The dominant group does not want that. So just as much as there are people who are writing, producing films, what have you, trying to tell the truth, there are forces trying to silence that. That's the reality.
I'm not going to go off on the tangent, but because I'm going to bring us back to the camera, but I am going to say, I'm just going to throw it out there. Like there are actual laws being written right now to try and keep this kind of stuff out of schools, right?
Absolutely.
And by this kind of stuff, I mean like history, historical narratives that are actually true. But we will not go there. People in power, dominant group in power. We talked about Darnella Frazier having the wherewithal to pull out her phone and actually capture these moments. I like how you call her and others like her withstanders. But I want to go for a second back to the power that you were just talking about, because you give some stats about people who are in charge of producing media, behind the camera people, execs, all of this. I'm gonna say spoiler alert for this part of the book. They're all white. Okay. 97%, Bill. Okay. The people with the power behind the camera. And as you point out, for a long time in front of the camera mm-hmm. are white. Now, I think you said we've finally reached like representation in front of the camera when it comes to African-American actors in front of the camera, but that's representation and that's right now. And that still is not usually leading roles or all black casts or anything yep. like that. It's still a lot of tokenism in front of the camera. But maybe talk just a little bit about, because it, I want to say this, because you've got a great section and we can talk about historical narrative, but also like art imitating life and life imitating art. And so even though a lot of what's being produced is fictional, it's still culturally very formative, right? And so to talk about the power, the way that you talk about the power is not just valid. It's really an important conversation, part of this holistic conversation to talk about the power of the production part of it.
Yeah. So the representation in front of the camera is minimal still. So I we kind of broke even, but we're not, now it's time to make some progress. And I got a lot of friends in the industry that express their frustrations with the opportunities that are not there for many of them as it would be for their white counterparts. Just like the camera is important in terms of disrupting or creating a new narrative, it requires that representation. And representation says a couple of things. One, that you're seen, right? You're no longer invisible. You know, there was a time when white folks played parts for black people, like in Birth of a Nation, which means if they're playing those parts and they're writing that narrative, you don't have a voice in your own story. Mm-hmm. And the other part is if you're seen, you're valued. So representation speaks to value. Not only are you valued, but your story is valuable. I mean, if I tell you how many times I have spoken with people in the industry who battle in the writing room with white writers, or actors who will say to white writers, I wouldn't say this. Or because a white writer is writing a black narrative from a white perspective, which is usually not proximal to blackness. It's usually from over there and they're basing it off of stereotypes. So there's not only just value in those bodies and that group of people, but it's value in your stories. And then there's an authenticity that you bring for being able to not only be in front of the camera performing, but behind the camera directing and producing that, casting this new vision. Again, going back to disrupting narratives, casting this new vision. So for me to see, when I grew up, to see a Lou Gossett Jr., That's just like, wow. A Diane Carroll. Wow. Now beauty has brown skin and it's represented. It's not just blonde, blue eyes, thin, white skin. Now there's another shade of beauty here, right? And so that's why it's important in how the camera, when you talk about, you know, Ava and Spike and other filmmakers, John Singleton. You think about these filmmakers, they're making a statement about value, authenticity, truthfulness. You know, Michel Foucault talks about the connection between truth-telling and self-care. That to tell the truth is to care for yourself. So let's just think about that for a moment when we think about the camera. Darnella Frazier, MLK, they are telling the truth, according to Foucault, is self-care in the midst of trauma. Think about the tension there. The in-betweenness there. And so that's why it's important to have representation in front of and behind of, because that in of itself is self-care. It's self-care for me. Because it combats the image that I saw growing up of Black men in the news, portrayed mostly as they had no problem putting up the criminal, the mugshots of Black faces. But I didn't see them in many other places. So what does that do to me as a kid? And I'm internalizing that. So when someone comes and disrupts that narrative with their camera, with their writing, and they present this different image, this positive image, this more a fuller image, that's caring for me as a kid. So I think Foucault is right in terms of truth telling is self-care. It's caring for oneself. You know, how can you lead others, he says, if you don't care for yourself? But how can you be an activist without caring for yourself or your people? So I think that's why it's so important. The work of the camera, whether it's a Darnella Frazier or an Ava DuVernay, is so important for communicating value, authenticity, affirmation, care, caring for Black bodies. It's important work.
It is important work. I want to talk about Ava for a second. Because something that just came to my mind, even as I want to talk about When They See Us, which you talk about in the book, which was it is one of those series that will stay with me forever and ever and ever. I don't want to watch it a second time. But in some ways, I feel like I don't have to, because the images they're seared in my mind. I think, she may correct me if she hears this, I don't think my mom could finish it. And it was too hard. But part of what hit me when you were talking, because you mentioned Trump a few times in the book, and he has a little cameo in When They See Us. So for the people who don't know, I'll link it, but this is about the exonerated five who were at the time known as the Central Park Five, young teens who were wrongly accused and convicted of an attempted rape. That happened in Central Park in New York in the 80s, I think, in the early 80s. And Donald Trump makes this cameo because he had, if I'm remembering correctly, this is kind of on the fly here. He put like a full page ad in the Times or something like that of like, or I don't know if it was in the Times, a full page ad basically saying death penalty for these kids. And anyway, it was outrageous, horrible, horrible stuff. But what came to my mind when you're talking is as influential as that art was, and this is not fiction. I mentioned it being fiction before, Power Behind the Camera. This was not fiction. This was a story, a real story. But sometimes the retraction does not make the same. Most of the time, the retraction does not make the same kind of news as the original story, right? So a newspaper journalist, right, put something in there and then they realize, oh, crap, that fact wasn't right or whatever. And they go and they journalistically do the correct thing and morally do the right thing. But that retraction or that edit, you know, back in the day when, Phil, you and I used to you read real newspapers, right, where it was printed like on the third page, you know, or something like that. It was a real short paragraph. It's not like they redid the entire headline to show this retraction, right, this correction of facts, this truth that could care for people well doesn't get as much airtime as the original story. And I think that that's kind of a profound thing about humanity, right? But even thinking about Ava's work specifically with When They See Us, super influential. I mean, she's on Oprah for crying out loud, you know, all of the things, right? But A, is it as influential as the original narrative? B, obviously lives were completely destroyed by this. And then C, you have another really influential character, namely the former president of the United States, still with the same narrative, not specifically saying these boys are guilty, but still with the same narrative. These boys are dangerous, right? Boys who look like them are dangerous. People who don't look like us are dangerous. You kind of talk about the them, us, you know, exchange in the book a bit. And so I'm just kind of, I don't even know if there's a question in there. I'm just kind of like looking for a partner in this conversation and kind of process this of how even when the power is beginning to shift or be shared or things like that, how, I don't know. I mean, there's not just catch up to do, right? But there's dynamic even as that new art is being shared.
Yeah, that's a lot. you know, when I think back to, you know, Donald Trump, first of all, understanding what he did back then gives more context of who he is today.
Right. Yeah.
And the fact that he's still trying to save face. And I've always seen him as an embodiment of white supremacy, like a physical embodiment of it. That's why it's so easy for many people who either subscribe to white supremacy consciously or unconsciously are drawn to it. Like they are formed by it. And that allegiance and that loyalty to Trump or defending him or being silent in the face of that, because he's a microcosm of that, when you think about what he did, he made a statement. It was without being informed. I could say motivated by racism or what have you. Then years later, refuses to simply say, I was wrong. I was flat out wrong. Because he has to save face. There's a preservation there. And that's one of the dangers, in my opinion, of white supremacy or whiteness. Its tendency to preserve itself. By all means, by any means. Rather than, because that's what the whole thing about banning books and not getting the history out, the full picture out, is the preservation of whiteness at the end of the day. And most people may not agree with that or make that connection, but you got to go back to what founded this nation and what was the motivation behind it. This God-ordained Christian white supremacy, Christian white male supremacy. That's literally the foundation. That's how this country was founded on. And it's this hierarchy that places that person at the top. You can't just ignore that and not see that play out even today. And so when I see Donald Trump doing what he does and says what he says and not even having the humility to, I was wrong. I'm so sorry. Where's that in the American narrative?
Thank you.
Where is that in, instead of, well, slavery ended 150 years ago, so racism is not existing today. What is that? So we'll never move forward with justice and a beloved community because many people won't even acknowledge that the past was as bad as it was or that there's still a legacy of that past. So, and I'm talking about Mitch McConnell, a senator, said this on national TV. Well, slavery ended 150 years ago. So what about Jim Crow, segregation? Well, that's not racism. What about mass incarceration? Well, that's not racism. Racial profile, that's not racism. Disparities in hiring practices, the wealth gap. None of those are implications of racism. Black kids being suspended at three and a half, four times more times than white kids. That's not possibly racism. I mean, we can go in every aspect of society and you will see the disparities along racial lines, particularly between white and black, but not to exclude the Asian experience, the Native experience, and the Latino experience, but the polar opposites between white and black are the most prominent. I mean, it's the most, you know, the greatest differences. And so I'm kind of rambling right now, but when I go back to Donald Trump and how he behaved back then and now, to me, is an embodiment of whiteness.
It goes to my favorite Mark Charles quote, which the first time I heard him say it, he was talking about women making 70 cents on the dollar to men. But his answer to that is, it's the same answer to what you're saying right now, which is the Constitution is working. The Constitution was written, he says, and it's true, for and by white landowning men. And so when we see these kinds of things that you have just described, the school experience, the racial wealth gap, the hiring, the incarceration, Jim Crow, when we see all of this, the answer is the Constitution is working.
Yes.
This is how our country was designed to work.
Yes.
For and by white landowning men. And so when we see these discrepancies, it's by design.
Yep.
It was on purpose. It was on purpose. We have a bunch of makeshift things where we've sought to fill some holes here and there, but it's working to preserve whiteness. As you say, this is how we shouldn't be shocked by this. This is how it's designed. And so it's operating exactly how it was designed to operate.
And we have to have that as central to the conversation, and not just among people of color, allies, women, not just among those groups. It has to be that white folks cannot be afraid to reflect deeply and critically about whiteness and the implications of white supremacy, how it benefits the white community. You can't be afraid to have that conversation. So more and more people have to be willing to have that conversation. And otherwise, we're going to be having the same talks 20, 30 years from now. Just a younger versions of us.
I want to give you a chance to end with someplace different, but before that, I want to, and that'll be wherever you want to end, by the way. But before that, I want you to talk about that for a second, because if I'm remembering correctly, where you talk about asking white people to reflect on that deeply, is the place where you give, it was a personal, you know, somewhat trivial example of your jump shot, right? And so I feel like we're kind of coming back to where we started of like, it's going to be critiqued. No one likes to be critiqued, right? But we need that in order to better ourselves, right? So I would say if you were having this conversation with a white friend, but I'm sure you've had this conversation with many white friends. So what are some of the things that you say when you share your heart about this and asking white people to reflect on these questions and these truths about our history deeply?
Great question. What I'm learning more and more, rather than trying to, in terms of the people who are most resistant, the people who are just not there, and they're really it's challenging to have these conversations. What I'd learned to do is ask them questions and now you have to wrestle with the question. And sometimes it's more disarming and sometimes it's not, but, you know, especially Christians, you know, was slavery bad? Was that racism? Yes. Okay. Was Jim Crow segregation? Was that racism? Okay. And I'll just ask like basic stuff, to where you have to answer truthfully and honestly. And then when you start to see the gymnastics, the linguistic gymnastics happen, then I got to pull them back in. And I'm just asking questions. And I'm forcing you to have to wrestle with these realities. Rather than me telling you and imposing upon you, I'm asking you the questions. Factual questions. Did this happen? Is this the wealth gap? Are kids, Black kids and brown kids, suspended at a much higher rate? Go look it up. You don't believe me, go look it up, right? Hiring practices. Is this happening? And then at the end of the day, if someone is still refuting that, then for me, the conversation is going to be short. That is someone that I will not give energy to. I'm treating them like Jesus treated the Pharisees sometimes. When they tried to trap him, neither will I answer your question. In other words, I'm not engaging you. And I had to realize I'm not for everyone. This subject matter is not going to be for everyone. Everyone's not going to be on board. There are always going to be elements or aspects of society, factions of society, that are going to be resistant to even to truth. So, and I'm not talking about controversial stuff. I'm talking about basic, fundamental truth, facts, because there's something they're trying to hold. There's something they have a greater allegiance to. I'm not trying to fight with that allegiance. I'm not trying to take your fingers from gripping that. That's not my job. So I've had to come to a place where I'm going to ask some questions, and those questions will let me know where you are. And if you're not willing to, because I'm not going just by opinion, I'm going by facts, data, experience, testimony, observations. And then I know that conversation is going to be pretty short. Because I got to look out. I also have to look out for my own well-being. And I don't have the energy to keep engaging like that.
Well, because it's almost the reciprocal of what we talked about earlier with Foucault, right? If telling the truth is self-care, then having someone spout those lies back at you is going to be detrimental to your self-care,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So you got to protect yourself in those moments.
Yep. Yeah, so sure. You know, for me, my health is number one, mental, physical, blood pressure, my heart, my cholesterol, all that stuff is number one, stress level. I will write, I will teach, speak, lecture, I will dialogue. When I sense that it is adversely affecting me, I will pull back, I will disengage, I will not let this thing kill me. I won't. So that person who does not want to hear me, I will move on to the next. Maybe someone else can reach them, because that has happened too. And I got to be okay with that.
Right. Or maybe there are some people who will just be unreachable.
Yeah.
And don't wear yourself out on it. Yep. All right, Phil, I showed you my cards at the beginning of this conversation. I said, I wish I had a great outline. I did have some notes this time. But since I didn't have this spectacular outline, what did I not get to that you wish we would have? I mean, I will just say already there's probably about six things that I wish we could have, but we just can't. So that's why I'll put the link to buy the book in the notes, because it's just so rich and good. There's just so much obviously that we can't get to in this time, but what for you is kind of still hanging out there right now?
You know, I think wanting to make sure people understand what I mean by the prophetic lens, the prophetic aspect, and using Walter Brueggemann's framework in prophetic imagination, talks about, I'm paraphrasing, nurturing and nourishing essentially a new consciousness. But also in doing that, it's criticizing and energizing. And I think the camera does that inherently. The camera, especially when we have this catalog of content now, it inherently criticizes, say, policing. It inherently criticizes white supremacy. It inherently criticizes those who within the workplace may perpetuate microaggressions. It is inherently critical just in capturing the event. But it's also intended to energize toward a new community. Like something new has to come from this. We can't just, and that's what, going back to Emmett Till's mom, she wanted them to see her son. Something good, something different has to happen from this. Otherwise, this is all in vain. So a new humanity, a new community, a new consciousness. And you started to see hints of that in 2020, and much of that has died down, but that's why it has to continue. Not just capturing content on the camera and publishing it, but the conversations, the lament, the grief, the activism, and not just from Black folks or people of color, but white folks too. That's preserving the nation. If you're not willing to do that, you're not trying to preserve the nation. You're trying to preserve something within that. And so this energize, this being critical of the dominant consciousness, but energizing a new consciousness in a new community. That's the purpose of the camera. And you could see that clearly in the civil rights movement. You could see hints of that with what happened with Darnella Frazier and Arbery's footage. And more footage continues to come out, more events are happening, but that's what you see. That's what needs to happen.
It's incredible. Phil, I can't thank you enough. I'm thrilled that you came back a second time to talk about this. I'm more thrilled that you wrote a second book. This is, well, oh, go ahead.
No, I was gonna say, I'm excited you had me back. Thank you so much. Thank you. I always love our engagement from DC when we met to now, just always lively, enlightening. I love it. Thank you.
Phil, me too. And even early coffee in Pasadena, right? Yeah. We can do that. Yeah. The new book is The Prophetic Lens, The Camera and Black Moral Agency from MLK to Darnella Frazier. This is available September 13th. Is that correct?
You can order now. Yep, you can order now. People are getting their books now. Let's make it a bestseller if we could.
This is exciting. It's so good. I will put the link for all of that and everything that we talked about today in the notes. Thank you so much, Phil.
Thank you.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.